Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Iraqi Voices. This is your host, Hassan Haddad. Iraqi Voices is a podcast that showcases authentic perspectives and insights about current developments in Iraq. Iraqi Voices is produced by 1001 Iraqi Thoughts. In less than 3 weeks, Iraqis will head to the polls and vote in the country's national parliamentary election. To discuss the latest political developments, I am joined once again by Ali Al-Mawlawi, who specializes in Iraq's political economy. Also here is Mohammed Al-Wa'ili, contributor to 1001 Iraqi Thoughts, focused on development and reform in Iraq. Last but not least is Hamza Haddad, an adjunct fellow at the Center for New American Security and editor at 1001 Iraqi Thoughts. Gentlemen, I thought we'd start where we left off last time. We talked about a political assassination, political violence in this election season. For anybody who missed that episode, we're talking about Safa al-Mashhadani, who's a member of Baghdad's provincial council and a member of the sovereignty alliance that is run by Khamis al-Khanjar. And this week, several arrests were made by the Ministry of Interior and the Popular Mobilization Forces. Ali, can you tell us a little bit about who these suspects are?
So the Ministry of Interior announced 5 suspects who were all arrested. All of them appear to belong to the tribal Hashid based in Barmia. And 3 of them also are from the Mashhadani clan, the same clan as the victim. And it does seem, based on the information that's been given to the public so far, is that this appears to be a sort of a turf war during the elections between rival groups. And so for now, it's still not entirely clear what the motives are, but I think it has to some degree allayed concerns about this being sectarian driven. There were suggestions initially that Shia militias had been involved. For now, it doesn't appear to be the case. I think that we did go through a very precarious period last week where sectarian tensions were quite high. And the government has been quite quick to make these arrests and hopefully should calm tensions moving forward.
And those initial allegations didn't make sense given that Safa was known to be pro-Hashid. As you said, 3 of the 5 suspects are members of the tribal Hashid from his own clan. So I didn't really understand why everybody focused on the Hashid straight away, given that he was an ally.
I think it's natural when you have armed groups affiliated with political parties that people will make that assumption. That's always the fear, and that's the reality we have in Iraq. But this was a very unfortunate incident. It has put a dark cloud on this election. The only positive takeaway was that it was not sectarian violence, because that could have snowballed into something much worse.
I think there's always going to be someone who is going to use sectarian rhetoric to gain a few votes. But thankfully, Iraq also has overcome this, I think, and the appetite of the public is not sectarian at this moment. And this is actually a good indicator. So you will always, whenever something happens, you will always hear a few voices that want to use some populist tactics to get some votes. But personally, I think these tactics are very ineffective these days. And this is a good thing.
Exactly. My hope is that is the first and the last violent incident in this election campaign, and that things go smoothly and peacefully between now and Election Day on the 11th of November. Speaking of sectarian tactics, previously we've discussed the fact that a lot of candidates are running on sectarian platforms to the point that they're not publishing a manifesto detailing what their policies would be if they were successful in the election and become members of parliament. One person who is an exception to that is Mohammed Tawfiq Allawi, who some of you might know is a former minister. And in 2020, he was the prime minister designate and was unsuccessful in forming a cabinet after Adel Abdel Mehdi resigned. he is running in these elections. He's published his manifesto. And recently he did an interview, and the interviewer started digging into the policies listed in that manifesto. And that is when a staffer handed him a piece of paper saying, you should withdraw from the interview. And it took Mohammed Tawfiq Alawi 6 minutes to actually get off the set, saying that I'm no longer continuing this because you don't actually understand the policies in the manifesto. My question here is, why put out a manifesto if you're not able to articulate it to the point that a TV presenter, let alone the public, are able to understand it and question you about it so that we can have a focused discussion on substance?
It clearly was a missed opportunity for someone like Alawi. We all know is an intelligent person who can articulate his ideas well, and he should have taken that opportunity, having chosen to go on the show beforehand. And even if he saw the presenter looking to get him or catch him in any way, he should have been more prepared, and he should have taken that opportunity to discuss his manifesto. This could have been an opportunity for him to at least be an example of, this is how you run a campaign.
Yeah, I think it's very important that candidates these days are able to respond to questions about their platform. We usually have been seeing politicians giving empty promises and talking about things that they are actually not, that is not in their authority to do. For instance, paving streets or finding jobs for government jobs specifically for people. The public expects from legislators to actually draft good laws and vote on them. But usually candidates actually go and talk about what they will offer as if they are executive officials. So the least, as Hassan is saying, the least any candidate should be is to respond to questions about their platforms. And these platforms should be accessible to people. Any manifesto shouldn't be something that is cryptic to the public and not easy to explain.
While we're also talking on the subject of how you should be running election campaigns, I think we haven't touched on ones that I think, in my opinion, have been quite atrocious. For example, you've got former Prime Minister Nourin Maliki for State of Law Coalition, who seems to be going on a whole fear-mongering campaign. Doesn't talk about any policy, but is constantly fear-mongering about the return of the Ba'ath. You have someone like Ammar al-Hakim of the National Wisdom Movement, who previous elections or since the iteration of his movement in 2017 has tried to portray himself as an Iraqi nationalist, but has now seemed to push towards being a Shia leader only. And then you also have the same election campaigning from the Kurdistan Democratic Party up in Iraqi Kurdistan. It's the same rhetoric that I feel like we've been hearing since 2005.
When it comes to fear-mongering, I specifically remember caretaker Prime Minister of Kurdistan region, Masroor Barzani, saying, quote, "There is no force that can think of occupying the Kurdistan region as long as the KDP exists," end quote. And I'm thinking to myself, who exactly is trying to occupy Kurdistan region? Who's even thinking of occupying Kurdistan region? That such remarks need to be made during an election campaign. So clearly, in terms of the KDP, there are no policies that they want to focus on. They want to focus on fear-mongering in order to drive Kurdish voters to come out and vote for them because the other, the Arabs, are coming for them.
His father as well, Masoud Barzani, told an audience recently that the delays to salary payments for KIG employees was the equivalent of the Anfal genocide that was inflicted upon them by the Ba'ath. So I think this tactic is part of an attempt to appeal to the not just the fear of citizens living in the Kurdistan region, but also to implicitly message that the only solution for their problems ultimately is independence and statehood.
You're absolutely correct that this is an old and tiring tactic by a lot of these fearmongers. But I think it's important to clarify that they have no leg to stand on. For example, when Malikis is constantly warning about the return of the Ba'ath has been gone in Iraq for over 2 decades and they no longer exist in Syria. So I don't think we really have to fear that. And with regards to the KDP, like you said, it's absolutely atrocious to be equating what's being done today with the genocide against them in the 80s, even if it is a terrible thing that citizens end up paying the price and a lot of public sector workers in Iraqi Kurdistan go months without getting paid. But that is not on the same level as Halepcha or the Anfal campaign. And with regards to Masroor Barzani talking about occupation and ridiculous things like that, we've seen recently the return of division in Iraqi Kurdistan between the KDP and the PUK. And when you saw campaigns to try to get direct federal payment to teachers in Sulaymaniyya, there was very little appetite for policymakers in Baghdad to jump on that opportunity. I think it's reality that you have a semi-autonomous Kurdistan region in Iraq, and there's very little appetite from policymakers in Baghdad to undo that.
That's a very important point, given that it was just over 1 year ago, on the 20th of October, 2024, that our fellow citizens in Kurdistan region went out and voted in the Kurdistan regional government elections. And to this day, those divisions that you just mentioned, Hamza, have led to the impasse that we see and the inability of the PUK and the KDP, the two leading Kurdish parties, to not be able to form a government.
I think aside from the internal divisions within the Kurdistan region, it's important to point out that a lot of the messaging that comes out of Kurdish leaders, particularly in Erbil, is that the problems between Baghdad and Erbil can be resolved if only you just enforce federalism and if only you just apply the constitutional provisions that determine the contours of federalism. And I think this is a bit of a red herring, really. And you can prove this with a very simple thought experiment, actually. So imagine you gave the Kurdish leadership in Erbil carte blanche to determine the contours of federalism. You allowed them to draft the oil and gas law. You let them determine the fate of Kirkuk and the disputed territories. And you let them interpret all of the constitutional provisions that determine federal powers versus regional powers. And in return, you ask of them to renounce their aspirations for statehood, and you ask them to deny their right to self-determination. What do you think the response will be? Well, of course, the response will be that self-determination is an inalienable right. And this is understandable, and I personally sympathize with this view that the Kurds will always aspire to statehood. In 1920, the Treaty of Sèvres promised the Kurds a pathway to statehood. And then the Treaty of Lausanne came along and it totally reneged on that promise. And so it's understandable that the Kurds would feel a sense of historic injustice. In addition to all of the oppression that has been inflicted upon them, particularly under the Ba'ath Party. And so the point is, though, that to claim that the issue between Baghdad and Erbil is one to do with federalism is actually very disingenuous, because the aspiration for independence will always be there for most of the Kurdish leadership. And so I think what needs to happen is, of course, there is no easy solution to resolving issues between Baghdad and Erbil. But by definition, if you have aspirations for statehood, and I don't mean simply wishful thinking, but you're actively working towards that long-term goal, then by definition, it's not in your interest to see a Baghdad that is strong and cohesive and that is able to enforce its authority on the rest of Iraq. And so this is an inextricable problem that I think Baghdad and Erbil will continue to face moving forward. And it doesn't matter how many interim deals you come up with to resolve or to attempt to resolve the revenue sharing problem, those deals will always have to be renegotiated because they will never be fully enforced and complied with by both parties.
Speaking of federalism, during the last week, Hamza, you published a piece with Brookings with Dr. Marcina Shamuri. Can you please add a little bit to what Ali has just said?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research on federalism in Iraq over the last few years, and I saw that interim Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa was using Iraq as a cautionary tale to not implement federalism in Syria. And I thought it was important to counter that. Now, how willing the Syrians are to implement that, that's for Syrians. But at least what this piece did was it set the record straight that despite everything that Ali spoke about, the shortcomings of the relations between Baghdad and its Kurdistan region, federalism seems to be the best solution for what we have. Because at the end of the day, none of us were alive 100 years ago. And geopolitics of today still doesn't allow for a Kurdish state. But it's still a significant nation that deserves respect, deserves its dignity. And the best way forward in that is through federalism in Iraq. Despite all the problems that we just spoke about, despite having harsh parties in Baghdad that might try to take advantage when they're stronger, or having ultra-nationalist Kurdish parties like the KDP that are more difficult to work with than other parties, at the end of the day, this is the state borders that we have to work within. And I don't see a better system than the federal system that we have. Can it be better? Of course, it can always be better. But that means both sides need to be more frank. And it's just a shame that during election season, we couldn't be farther away from reality when discussing issues like federalism.
Yeah, in many ways, federalism is an interim solution to the problems between Baghdad and Erbil. But I think the point is that regardless of what federalism looks like in Iraq, it will not fully resolve the divergent aspirations that exist between those who govern in Baghdad and those who govern in Erbil. Ultimately, when your aspiration is long-term statehood, that does conflict fundamentally with the notion of being part of a state. And that's the point, that federalism can provide a good level of political calm between opposing sides. But in the case of Iraq, I think that there needs to be a much more frank conversation between leaders in Baghdad and Erbil about what needs to be done to resolve all of the outstanding issues that exist.
And just a quick note about federalism. I think that in order for federalism to work, we need a highly functioning state. And maybe this can be like a motivation for Iraqis, both in Baghdad and in Erbil, to work hard on improving, actually reforming the state in order to make federalism as effective as well, not only as a political necessity, but also a way to manage the country better.
That's very difficult to do when you struggle to, like Hassan said, takes over a year to form a regional government in Iraqi Kurdistan. You've got provisions in the Iraqi constitution that have been left for decades unresolved. You even have within Iraqi Kurdistan itself, they've never ratified their constitution, and they established their region back in 1992. So you definitely need functioning institutions to manage that relations. And we are behind in that. But I think what has happened in Syria and the ongoing negotiations between Damascus and their Kurdish population does shed light that we are ahead in our relationship when it comes to federalism.
The discussion on federalism is one that is very interesting, and I'd like to pick up on it in coming episodes. On this note, I want to thank all three of you for joining me once again for this thought-provoking discussion. That's it for this week's episode. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to receive notifications about a new episode from Iraqi Voices. Until next time, take care.